anybody else has an idea for a question? April said she'd like to hear about sacrifice and gratitude.
I haven't finished it. I'm about halfway through, but she writes a lot about suffering, which kind of ties in with sacrifice, and ties that in with karma and reincarnation. And I know this is probably a great topic, but
that's okay.
I'm dying to see how it ends. I haven't.
It doesn't end. It goes in a big circle. Well, what I was thinking about talking about tonight is samsara, which means cyclic existence, which is what the Buddhists considered a big problem to be. So actually, we can talk about all these things, all wrapped up together. So the word samsara does literally mean cyclic existence. It means the situation that we all find ourselves in. And the reason it's cyclic existence is described by Buddhists as being an issue is because, to use a modern metaphor, the same shit happens over and over again. Yeah, and so why is it that the same stuff happens over and over again? I mean, you have a job, and why is it you always end up with a boss who does X, Y, and Z? And always, you know, the bosses are always different, but they're always doing X, Y, and Z instead of A, B, and C or something like that. So so that's cyclic existence. And the problem is not just the same stuff happens over and over again, but the stuff that happens over and over again is unsatisfactory. And in fact, I once read somebody saying that the idea of cyclic existence is not so much just that things happen over and over again, that the image that the Buddha used when he talked about cyclic existence wasn't exactly what was a wheel on an axle, which was kind of a new thing at the time, by the way, because this is 2,500 years ago. There weren't any roads, so the idea of a wheel on an axle was sort of a new thing. But that the wheel was on the axle sort of not correctly, so it wobbled around as it turned. So what he was trying to say is the problem with cyclic existence isn't just that the same stuff goes around and comes around and happens over and over again, but it's not quite right. Something's not quite right. The wheel isn't spinning quite right. And we know that. We experience that, and we don't like it. Because cyclic existence could be good. I mean, for example, one of the things that Buddhists talk about with cyclic existence is they say that you can go through different states of mind. Some people, well, actually what they say is you can reincarnate through different realms of existence, that you can be an animal, that you can be a god, that you can be in hell, that you can be in the human world, and so on and so forth. And that the way you cycle through these different realms depends upon sort of the karma that you accumulate, because the Buddhist teaching is very strictly about cause and effect. Nothing happens except as a lawful outcome of something else that happened. There's no arbitrariness. You know, Einstein said God doesn't play dice with the universe, and Einstein liked Buddhism. He thought that it made a whole lot of sense. At least it fit his sense of what's real. So you can cycle through all these existences, and you can get into heaven, and Buddhists describe heavens. They're nice. They do a much better job of describing heaven than even the Muslims or the Christians. I mean, they talk about it's always warm, and if you want something nice, there's always a tree next to you, and it just falls out of the tree, whatever it is. And they kind of go on and on like this. they do an equally good job of describing hell, and they've actually thought of hells that even the Christians couldn't think of. So, but we won't go there. So anyway, so you can get into all of these things, but even if you get into them, there's a wobble. There's something that's not quite right. Even in heaven, there's something that's not quite right, and when you're in heaven, you know that. So even in the ordinary world, there's something that's not quite right, and you kind of know that. For example, I don't know if you've experienced this, Brian, when you're skiing, you could be in an absolute perfect situation of skiing where everything is just right, the snow is right, the air is right, you're doing everything right, you're in the zone or whatever that experience is. But some part in the back of your mind knows that it won't be like this tomorrow. As perfect as this is, it's going to not last. And if you're totally into right here, right now, that might be okay. But then there's always this little thing in the back of your mind, which is, it's not going to stay this way. So Buddhists say that the thing about cyclic existence is some part of us knows that we're going to lose what we want, we're going to gain what we don't want, and if we've got it right now, that we're going to be uncomfortable about either of those two. And that's always sort of going on there. And so the problem with cyclic existence is not just that it goes around over and over again, but that our relationship with it has got some problems. So what is it that's going around over and over again? So on the one hand, the way Buddhists talk about it is as if it sounds like they're talking about the world. You know, existence is a problem. And if you think about the world from the point of view of, say, being a peasant in India 2,000 years ago, well, yeah, it was pretty tough. You know, you got roasted in the sun when you're trying to get the crops in, and you got the monsoon came and it rained on you, and the kids died, and the wives died, or the husbands died, or you had, go through the whole thing. You can imagine what peasant life was like. It's sort of like, yeah, from that point of view, you could look at the world and say that it's kind of not so great. And that's often the way samsara appears to be, or often that's what it appears to be about, that the world is not so great. You know, that we're all getting older. Everything heads south. It's harder to get out of bed in the morning. You know, year by year it gets harder and harder, and so that's samsara. That's a simple way of talking about samsara. That's obvious. The more complicated way of talking about samsara, although I think Americans probably understand this more naturally, is that it's a matter of our own minds and that there's something going on in our own minds, like this part of our mind that knows the good stuff doesn't stick around and the bad stuff shows up. No matter how great summer vacation is, you've got to go back to school in the fall. I mean, as much fun as we had in Ireland, we were there for 10 days. That's a good long time to be in Ireland, but then when we'd been there for about 8 days, I started feeling like, oh gosh, we're going to have to leave. And so the last 2 days I was into, ugh, we're going to have to leave, rather than, boy, isn't it great to be here. That's samsara. But that was created by my own mind. It wasn't specifically anything that was going on in Ireland. I mean, day 10, 9, and 8 in Ireland more or less were the same. I mean, the weather was different in different places or something like that. But the main difference what was going on in my mind, what did I bring to the experience? So what does that mean to say that samsara is in the mind, that it's not just in the world? So then that gets a little bit more problematic to talk about, a little harder to talk about. So if we go back to looking at when we say we experience the world, we say samsara is in the world, if we look at what is our experience of that world that is supposed to be samsara, or anything else, or the world that's the perfect day for telemark skiing, or the first day of summer vacation, so that going back to school is really as far away as possible, you know, or the first morning I wake up in Ireland, so leaving is as far away as possible, you know. What is it Geez, I just lost my train of thought when I did that. We know that we're not naive realists about the world. We know that this thing that I see, that I'm sitting in, that I feel, that I hear, like the train whistles, all this kind of stuff, and the composition of all this into my experience of the moment, is something that I'm creating. I mean, we know that it's not literally objectively there. I mean, it is in its own way, but we know that my awareness of the world is something that's being created. We know that when we see something, for example, I think I'm looking at the wall, and I see a wall there, but if I really stop and think about what I learned in high school physiology about the way perception works, what I know is really going on is there is an objective something out there, that light is bouncing off that objective something, that wall, comes through the lens in my eye, it gets focused, it hits the retina, something happens in the neural system in my brain, it goes to the back of my head, it gets put together in my brain, and this image representation happens in my consciousness. And what I'm experiencing is that image representation in my consciousness that is a representation of what's out there, which is called the wall. But most of the time, because, I mean, you can't walk around thinking about that all the time. That would just be, like, you couldn't, I mean, you wouldn't be able to get down the street, probably, if you did that. So you mostly ignore that, and in fact, you systematically ignore what you actually know. I mean, you actually know that the sound that you hear, I mean, that railroad that I hear, that railroad cars that I'm hearing now, or my voice that you're hearing, I mean, you really know, because we're educated, that what's going on is there vibrations in the air, and that has some effect on the cilia after the tympanum moves around, and that, you know, the same process goes on, and I create this sound space. And then I label it, train. So now I know what that noise is. It's not even just a noise anymore, like labeling the wall a wall. It's not just that kind of sunset, orange, red, whatever it is, color. You know, it's kind of like there's a label attached to it. So if we say that that is samsara, that the wall is samsara, the train is samsara, the world is samsara, what we're really saying is, in fact, that samsara is of the objective world, but it's also of the mind, because that experience that we're having of anything is those two things coming together. It's the inner constructing a notion of the outer, and it's like you can't really separate the two from each other. If you're looking at the wall, you think that objectively you're seeing a wall, but in a certain way you're seeing your mind, because your mind has constructed that. You just make a habit of not noticing that that's your mind out there. And you make a habit of believing that it's just the wall, that your mind isn't here, your mind isn't out there. Or the reverse. You know, you believe that your mind is in here, so you walk around and there's all this stuff going on out there, and you think it has nothing to do with your mind. Right? So, you know, the boss, I'm talking about samsara, the boss who's always X, Y, and Z, no matter which boss it is, and you ask yourself, why is it that boss who has those characteristics always shows up in your life? Can't be the same boss over and over again. It's not. It's the same mind over and over again that is in relationship with another person who has the role of boss that presents itself in a certain kind of way, and then it configures that relationship. So you look at the boss, but you think it's her or him. You don't think it's my mind engaged with her or him that turns them into whatever that thing is that you say is out there. So you're following me so far, right? Okay. So when you say that, when Buddhists talk about samsara as if it's out there, as like the world is samsara, they really mean your mind, the world, that combination of those two things coming together is samsara. So that sounds like maybe bad news or a little weird in one way, but it's actually good news in another way. And the reason it's good news is there's not a lot you can do about the objective world. I mean, people grow and die. You know, lightning bolts come down. Winter comes, or winter goes away, depending upon how you feel about winter. You know, it's too hot or it's too cold. One person can turn the air conditioning up and it's too cold, and the other one turns it down and it's too hot. I mean, you know, it's like all that kind of stuff. It's like Well, the objective stuff, you can't really do much of anything about. And that was a distraction about the air conditioner, I'm sorry. The objective stuff, you can't do much of anything about. If you live above the, whatever it is, the 45th parallel in Oregon, it's going to get cold in the winter. That's just the way it's going to be. And if cold makes you uncomfortable, of course you could go someplace else, but then it'd probably be too hot. You know, and that's sort of the nature of existence. But, so that would be the bad news side, perhaps. But the good news side is if samsara is if your mind is in samsara or creating samsara or part of samsara, that's something that you can have some control over. Your mind you can change. You can't change whether or not winter is going to come. But you can change what your mind does in relationship to the fact of winter. For example, when I first moved to Indiana, after a while I realized, because I really didn't like winter, I mean, Los Angeles boy, right? Yeah. Okay. What am I going to do? Oh, I'll take up ice skating. So I'll find something that's fun to do that you can only do in the winter. So, I mean, that was like my mind saying, I can turn this objective thing into something positive. And take that as a metaphor for what the Buddhists are saying about the mind and in relationship to samsara, which is there are objective situations that are what they are, but the part which is your mind in that objective situation is subject to your own control. That part you can do something about. That doesn't mean it's easy to do something about that. I mean, we know that we're in a stressful situation with the boss who's X, Y, and Z, again, that there are going to be problems. And even when we know that it's us in that relationship that's generating the problems, it's not easy for the problems to deal with making the problems go away. It's not easy to extract ourselves from samsara. So what do we do about this? Well, there's a Tibetan Buddhist classic by Tsongkhapa, who's one of the great yogi saints of Tibet, lived in the 13th into the 14th centuries. And he's the one who founded the lineage that the Dalai Lamas are in and is the major lineage of Tibet. Tsongkhapa wrote a text called Three Principal Aspects of the Path. He took the whole Buddhist path, which is, and path means like getting from where things aren't okay to where everything is okay, getting from being sound asleep but walking to being wide awake and walking, from being ordinary to being a Buddha. That's what the path is. He boiled it down to three principles, three things that you need to work with, make it real simple. And those three principles are what's sometimes called renunciation. So this gets at your question about sacrifice, actually. Renunciation, wisdom, and altruism. So those are the three simple ways. And I'm not going to talk about all three of those things. But cultivating those three things are the path. And so if you cultivate those three things, you can make the movement from being walking and asleep, which is totally caught in samsara and not knowing it, to being wide awake and free of samsara because you fully understand what it is and how it works, and therefore you're free from it. Now, that doesn't mean you're free from objective reality. The Buddha died. He lived 80 years and then he died. I mean, his body fell apart, and as he was dying, he said to his monks, who were kind of like, whoa, we're losing you. It's like, can't you do something about this? You're the Buddha. He said, no, it's in the nature of bodies. They're composed, and so they fall apart. My body's the same. It's composed. It's going to fall apart. That's the way it is. See you later. You know, I'm out of here. So that kind of objective thing is nothing you can change. I mean, he died. He's gone, and physically gone. But the internal, how you relate to it, and what goes on inside is something you can do something about. And in fact, something you need to do something about. That's what the path is about, doing something about that inside. So of these three principal aspects, one, which is typically translated as renunciation, but could be called sacrifice, I think, because the way you were talking about what it was that Tenzin Palmo was doing, it seemed like she was sacrificing a lot, like to live in a cave for 12 years is to sacrifice a lot. Yeah, that would be tough. But she never said that. She said it was great. No, she said it was fantastic. And the only reason she left, she got busted. Her visa ran out in India, and the cops busted her and said, you're out of here in a few days. She wanted to find the cave, and it was hard to do, and everyone tried to talk her out of being in the cave, and she said, this is it, and this is what I'm going to do. And it was tough, but she thought it was totally great. So she didn't see it as a sacrifice. She saw it as like a vacation in Maui, basically. You know, it sounds like a real challenge. But the first principle of the path, which is in fact sort of what is being illustrated in her experience, is Geshe Sonam Rinchen, who has written one of the translations, he's made one of the translations of the Three Principal Aspects and written a comment, or given a commentary on it. It's a book which I happen to like a lot. Said, renunciation doesn't really mean giving things up. I mean, Tenzin Palmo gave things up. But he says, it doesn't really mean giving things up. It's like if you got a house and a family, it's not like you have to run away from your family and sell your house. It doesn't mean renunciation in that sense of like wearing a loincloth and having a staff and one bowl and wandering around India. It means giving up on the world or giving up on existence. And what he means when he says giving up on existence, he means giving up on the idea that existence or the world is going to satisfy you in a fundamental way. That's what you sacrifice. That's what you renounce. So he's not saying that, Kay and I are together and you need to, and we got this nice house and I got a reasonable job, even though at the moment it might be driving me crazy. The Buddhist path is not saying, I can't be married to Kay, I have to get rid of the house and I have to quit my job and, you know, go out and live in the woods outside of Joseph or something like that.
Nice cave, I'm sure.
Yeah, there might be, and I would be really cold and unhappy in it. What he's saying is, it's actually what you need to do is something which is more difficult, which is give up on the idea that being in this house with this wife, with this nice job, is fundamentally going to make me happy. Not that Kay isn't a sweet person, or that it's not a nice house, or that the job is okay, but more that because of the way we are built as existing beings, fundamentally, nothing that happens in this world, no matter what I achieve, accomplish, or put together, in itself, will satisfy me. I could say, you know, if only I lived on the coast of Northern California in a mid-50s modern house and had, you know, $3 million in the bank and I was living on the interest, although I'm not even sure you can live on the interest in $3 million anymore. If I'm thinking that's going to make me happy, guess what? It's going to be the same old me that's sitting in that house on the beach with that big bank account, and if I'm not happy here, I'm not going to be happy there. Now, you know, you have to take this within a certain kind of context. I mean, there is real poverty, and real poverty creates real problems for people. So Buddhists do talk about the importance of opportunity and leisure. You have to have the opportunity and leisure to have a certain kind of life if you don't want to just be bound to the wheel of existing, merely surviving. Because if you're bound to that, if you're like the Indian peasant that's just, you know, trying to survive from one year to the next, you're not going to be able to have enough self-consciousness and leisure to practice anything. But once you have that, getting a whole bunch of other stuff is not going to meet the fundamental need that the inner development is going to meet. I mean, I went to elementary school with, I mean, I used to play in the mud with this little kid, a classmate of mine, who turned out to be really smart and went to school and made piles of money. And he made so much money that it was never enough. And when he finally got busted by the Securities and Exchange Commission, they fined him $1 billion. And he still had $2 billion left. Now, I have to ask myself, what happened to that guy? You know, how was it that he had to put together such scams to get that rich that after 10 million or 20 million or 100 million, it wasn't enough. What happened there? I mean, there's some place where he believed that that more was really going to be better in something. It was going to be something was going to happen if he had more of it. Well, nothing happened by getting more of it, because he was on a treadmill for more, and it didn't happen for him. Right? I'm sure it didn't happen for him. So this has to be taken within a certain context. I mean, there is too little. There's no question about the fact that it's possible to have too little. But getting more beyond a certain level isn't going to solve the problem, because the problem has to be solved inside. And Dalai Lama says he's met lots of rich people who are miserable, and he's met lots of poor people who are happy. One of the things that tells him is that rich does not equal happy, and poor does not equal miserable, that there's something else that's going on in there. But again, I'm not saying that poverty is necessarily a good thing. I'm just saying that understanding that samsara is resolved from within is the key. And so how do you give up on this world, which is both the inner and the outer world, how do you give up on this world and live in it comfortably and not do something stupid is a significant challenge, right? And not do something stupid could mean a lot of things. Not do something stupid could mean I'll only be happy if I live on the coast. Well, that might be something stupid. Or something stupid might be, I'll only be happy if I sell my house, get divorced, throw a backpack on my back, and you know what I'm saying? It's like that's not gonna do it. Something's gonna have to happen here. So that's what the real question is and the real challenge is. Now what's complicated then is, how are we doing time wise? What's complicated then, I'm just about out of time, is that you have to see how samsara exists within your own mind in order to not be caught by the samsara within your own mind. Because that's where the problem is. It's not changes in the world. It's the samsara in your own mind. So the issue there then is seeing your own mind. How do you see your own mind? Because, see, the way we go through life is we go through life and it's kind of like I'm thinking something and that carries me along. I'm thinking that I want to have some breakfast and so my feet go down the stairs and into the kitchen. I'm thinking that I'm really tired so my feet go up the stairs and I'm in bed. It starts with my mind and then my body follows. But when I'm having the thought I'm tired and I want to go to bed, or I'm having the feeling I'm hungry and I want to eat something, there's a connection between me, for lack of a better term here, because we know that me is a problem word, there's a connection between me and the mind that's having the thought about going downstairs or upstairs or whatever the case may be. I'm fully connected with that mind, that thought that's having those feelings or that's having that impulse, and I'm following it. So the question is then how to get disconnected enough from the mind to be able to know it for what it is and not be caught up in it, because we're totally engaged in it. In fact, it is what we think we are. This is the hard part, that we think we are my mind. It's like Descartes, I think, therefore I am. I mean, that's the ultimate of that. It's like, my mind is what I am. And we're convinced that that's true. And therefore, we're locked into the cyclic existence that's created by our mind, which has got all these complicated aspects to it, which we haven't talked about very much, but maybe eventually we will. And the mind has good sides and bad sides, positive and negative, you know, useful and useless. So I'm not slamming this. I'm just saying that we're wrapped up in it so fully that we don't have the ability to step away from the problematic aspects of that. And we're caught with them. So Buddhist practice then to a great extent is about identifying the mind, recognizing how it works, and getting enough of a disconnect from the mind to be able to stand back and see it and not be caught in it. And this is a great challenge. I mean, I think that in my entire life, maybe it was only Tuesday morning of this week that I was able to sit down and I could actually, in a certain way, I say see, I don't mean literally see, but in a sense cognize, that is my mind. I mean, it was actually there objectively as something other than what I was, and I could actually see it working. And one of the reasons that that happened was when we were in Ireland, we were in the main shopping area of Dublin, which is called Grafton Street. And in fact, people don't even talk about going downtown. They talk about going to Grafton Street. And it's got all these great stores on it. It's got Marks and Spencer on one side, and it's got Brown Townhouse on the other, and it's got... hold on. Weir's Jewelry Store, and like Kay was looking at the fashions there saying, man, this place is amazing, and these people are great looking and everything else. But I stood there, and I just saw this sea of people going back and forth, up and down this street, which is closed to car traffic. Only you can only walk on it. I just saw this sea of people, and everybody I looked at, all I could see was these bodies with these crumpled up looking faces and intense looks, like moving really quickly forward in some direction, driven by this kind of inner mental construction about something that they had to do or they needed or something like that. And just like, everybody get out of the way, here I come. And it was like waves and waves of this. And I just kept seeing it over and over again. And I'm standing and was like, okay, there is the mind. There is the mind, individually and collectively. It was just so apparent. And maybe one of the reasons it was so apparent was that, you know, I'm close enough to who the Irish are because I'm a Westerner, but I'm different enough that something seems to have stood out at that particular point, you know, and I saw it really clearly. And that stuck with me. So when I came back here and I was meditating one morning, I could watch, you know, okay, here's this wave of stuff going on. I'm worried about this. I have to do this. We have this upgrade, and this software isn't working. And what am I going to tell the faculty? And it's like, that's your mind, David. Those are your thoughts. And it's kind of like, okay, just back off. And actually, I got to a place where it was like there was this massive thing, I don't know how to describe this, that was sitting in the center of my head, which was like this going on. I really cannot describe this to you. And then I was someplace else looking at it completely peacefully. So it was still going like that, but I was over here watching it. And it was kind of like, minds do that, bodies breathe, and here's the breathing, and there's the mind-ing, and I'm over here. And that went on for about 20 minutes. That was real great. So that was 20 minutes of my entire life that, you know, like there it was, and here I am. But I saw it real clearly. You know, I saw it real clearly. There was just like, okay, so this is what I need to work with. So that thing that was going on there, that's samsara. Not because there's anything wrong with the mind doing its thing. It's a tool. Like there's nothing wrong with breathing. Minds construct reality. Minds help us get things done. It gets us to work. Minds help us take care of other people. They raise the kids. They grow the food. They do all this good stuff. They also do a lot of crappy stuff, you know. They take us to a rock. They rip people off. Or minds, you know, minds do all kinds of different things. The point is that it's, and I saw this clearly, and this is what Buddhists talk about, you can separate yourself from that. And you can watch the samsara going on, not be caught by it. That's the trick. The mind can be a tool, and it's always in the nature of samsara, because of what it is, and we'll talk about that more when we have more time, but you don't have to be caught by it. So one thing meditation practice does is it puts you in that place which ultimately, conceivably, can be separate from the mind. And this practice that we're working with, which is like taking on this other form, this image of the Buddha, it's like putting on the clothes of the Buddha, is a way of stepping away, or potentially stepping away from that samsaric mind. Here I am, Buddha. There's the mind. There's the body breathing. I'm in relationship to all these things, but I don't have to be caught by any of these things. So that's... ...35 minutes and 33 seconds. Not bad. I said I was only going to do half an hour, so that's it. So now we're going to meditate.